Dream of the Red Chamber, Chapter 106.
Okay, let's unpack this. We open this section with the patriarch of the family, Jia Zhang. He is visiting the matriarch, Grandmother Jia, and the atmosphere is just suffocating.
Yeah, you really have to understand the physical and psychological space Grandmother Jia occupies in this family.
Right.
She's an 80-something-year-old woman who has lived her entire life in a bubble of absolute insulated luxury. She is the moral and generational center of the family.
The ultimate authority figure.
Exactly. And right now, she is in a state of sheer physiological terror. I mean, she is hyperventilating. The text describes her as completely undone by the sudden intrusion of state violence into her sanctuary.
She basically tells Jia Zhang, like, I have never even heard these kinds of criminal things happening, let alone seen them with my own eyes in my own house.
Right.
She is weeping, saying she wishes she could just close her eyes and die rather than be forced to watch the family be destroyed. It's a complete sensory overload.
And honestly, it's not an overreaction. We need to look at who actually conducted this raid.
Yeah, this wasn't just a standard police visit.
Not at all. These aren't polite civil auditors showing up with clipboards. The family was raided by the Jinniwei.
Brocade guards.
Yes. Historically, in the context of the Ming and Qing dynasties that inform this novel, the brocade guard function essentially as the emperor's autonomous secret police.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they bypass normal judicial channels entirely. When they show up at your gate, they represent the absolute, terrifying, unchecked martial authority of the throne.
So the threat of execution, or, you know, the entire bloodline being exiled to the frontiers, is literally breathing down their necks.
Exactly.
Jia Zhang knows his brother is currently detained by these guards.
Yeah.
And Jia Zhang is doing what any son in a strict Confucian hierarchy would do, right?
Mm.
He is frantically trying to manage his mother's terror.
He's desperate to calm her down.
Yeah, he is dropping to his knees, taking the blame, saying, we, your unfilial sons, have brought this disaster upon you.
It is a performance of filial piety right at the edge of the abyss. I mean, he is trying to restore the social order of the household by taking the blame verbally, even though functionally he has absolutely no idea how to stop what is happening.
Right. He's just saying the words. And just as the panic reaches this crazy crescendo, there is an interruption.
A major one.
A clerk from the Prince of Beijing's office arrives at the estate. He brings a decree straight from the inner court, and what happens next gives the entire family a massive, jarring case of whiplash.
The emperor issues a partial pardon. It completely rewrites the reality of the crisis in, like, a matter of seconds.
Yeah. The emperor's decree basically states that out of profound pity for the recently deceased imperial concubine, who, by the way, was a daughter of the Jia family, he simply cannot bear to bring the full weight of the law down upon her relatives.
So he splits the punishment.
Right. Jia Shi, the brother whose branch was directly implicated, has his property confiscated. But Jia Zhang gets to keep his government post. And Jia Lian, the nephew who had been thrown into a prison cell, is ordered to be released.
It's an incredible reversal.
The emperor essentially tells them to go back to work, serve diligently, and just be grateful.
And the immediate reaction, of course, is overwhelming relief. I mean, Jia Zhang literally drops to his knees, facing the imperial palace, to thank the heavens and the emperor for this boundless mercy.
Naturally.
On paper, it looks like salvation. But if you actually look at the mechanics of imperial power, this is a masterclass in political optics.
Yeah, let's pull that apart, because this is absolutely not an exoneration.
No, not at all.
The emperor does not say, after reviewing the evidence, we find you innocent of all charges.
Precisely. The phrasing is entirely conditional and highly calculated. The emperor is sparing them only because of their proximity to the late concubine.
So it's a total PR move.
100%. The emperor must maintain the image of a benevolent, deeply feeling sovereign. If he executes or exiles the entire family of a woman who faithfully served him in the inner palace and who recently passed away.
He looks like a monster.
He looks callous. He looks ungrateful. And in the complex theatricality of the imperial court, that is a very bad look. So he issues a stay of execution. He hands them back their property deeds and their legal documents.
He returns their formal status.
Right. But he does not return their security. The sword is still hanging there. He just, you know, lengthened the thread a bit.
And the disconnect between the official stamped language of that decree and the physical reality on the ground is where things get truly dark.
The gap between the paperwork and reality is huge here.
Because the decree says, we are returning the assets that are not tied to illegal usury. But the narrative reveals what the boots on the ground actually did during the raid.
Yeah, the guards didn't just take the illegal stuff.
No, the Jinyue didn't just walk into the study, take the illegal loan contracts, and politely leave. They looted the estate.
Completely ransacked it.
They stripped the physical liquid wealth of the family. The text mentions, almost casually, that Jia Lian and his wife, Wang Shifeng, lose their massive private savings during the chaos of the raid.
And we are talking about an astronomical sum.
70,000 to 80,000 pieces of gold and silver. Just gone. Evaporated into the pockets of the guards.
It really highlights the massive gap between the law as it is written in the inner court and the law as it is executed in the courtyard.
It's like, imagine surviving a massive corporate bankruptcy. The SEC drops the charges, you breathe a sigh of relief, you think you're safe only to walk into your office and realize hackers drained your personal bank accounts during the chaos of the investigation.
That is a perfect analogy.
It's insane. So I have to ask, how much of that is a bug in the system and how much is a feature?
That's the big question.
Does the emperor know his elite guards are essentially acting like pirates, emptying the vaults of the aristocracy, and he just looks the other way because he can't control them? Or is this an intended unspoken mechanism of punishment?
The historical reality makes the latter deeply compelling. It is an unspoken structural feature of the imperial system.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, think about it. The emperor gets to issue the benevolent, merciful decree. He retains the absolute moral high ground, appearing as a forgiving father figure to his subjects. But by implicitly allowing his enforcers to pillage the liquid portable assets, the Jia family is fundamentally neutralized.
So they are defanged without the emperor ever having to issue a violent order.
Exactly. They get their official status back, they get to wear their robes of office, but they no longer have the financial resources to actually wield power.
They can't bribe anyone.
Right. They can't bribe officials, they can't maintain their vast network of influence. It is a highly efficient way of gutting a potential rival power center without taking the public relations hit of a mass execution. The family is left as a hollow shell.
That is terrifying. It's like an immune system response that attacks a virus. But instead of killing the host cell, it just strips out all the nutrients and leaves the cell alive but entirely paralyzed.
That's exactly what it is.
And that paralysis forces the Jia family into a completely new, deeply uncomfortable reality. The immediate threat of the executioner is gone. The adrenaline of the raid is fading. And now they actually have to assess the damage. Which brings us to Jia Zhang sitting down with Jia Lian.
The facade has been violently ripped away, and now the patriarch actually has to look at the foundation of his own house.
Yeah. Jia Zhang calls in Jia Lian, the nephew who was just released from prison, and Jia Zhang asks a very basic, very necessary question.
He wants to know how this happened.
Right. He wants to know about the high-interest usury, the illegal loan sharking that triggered this imperial raid in the first place. And Jia Zhang's framing is just so revealing.
It's incredible.
He says, I have an official career. I don't handle the household. But we are an aristocratic family. We are nobles. We don't act like common loan sharks. Who did this?
We really need to unpack Jia Zhang's psychology here because it is the root of the entire systemic failure. He is invoking the classic defense of the absentee executive.
Plausible deniability.
Yes, but it is deeply tied to the Confucian ideal. In that cultural framework, a true scholar official, a man of profound moral purity, does not concern himself with the vulgar mechanics of commerce.
So touching money is beneath him.
Exactly. Managing ledgers, haggling over interest rates, that is the domain of merchants. And in the traditional hierarchy, merchants are a lower social class. Jia Zhang's entire identity is wrapped up in his aesthetic of purity.
So his ignorance isn't an accident, it's a cultivated posture.
Precisely. If we connect this to the bigger picture, he views his detachment from the household finances not as a failure of leadership, but as proof of his virtue.
Wow.
He was busy with the big picture, reading the classics, performing government duties. He traded the actual gritty governance of his estate for the pure aesthetics of governance.
And that insistence on remaining clean is exactly what created the dark, unsupervised environment where corruption could just metastasize.
Absolutely.
And when he asked Jia Lian how this happened, Jia Lian's response is a masterpiece of middle management deflection.
Oh, he completely passes the buck.
He says, I didn't have any selfish motives. The household managers Lai Da, Wu Zhendang, Dai Liang, Zhu Rui, Wang Er, they are the ones who actually handle the accounts. Go ask them.
Throwing them right under the bus.
Right. And then Jia Lian drops the real anvil. He admits that for years, the estate's treasury has been essentially hollowed out.
The money is gone.
The silver flowing out has vastly exceeded the silver coming in. They have been running the entire massive empire on empty accounts.
Jialian is confessing that the aristocracy has been operating a massive Ponzi scheme of debt. They were maintaining the illusion of immense wealth by borrowing at extortionate rates against a future they couldn't possibly finance.
Wait, he tells his uncle he doesn't even know where the original loan money came from.
He has no idea.
He was just rubber stamping the paperwork the managers put in front of him to keep the lights on, and the banquet's funded.
What we are witnessing is the catastrophic result of delegation entirely divorced from oversight. You have a massive vacuum of power.
Everyone is looking the other way.
Exactly. Jia Zhang, the ultimate authority, refuses to look at the numbers because it offends his moral sensibilities. Jia Lian, the operational manager, refuses to understand the mechanics of the debt because he's desperate to maintain the lifestyle without taking responsibility for the cost.
So they created a massive blind spot, and the middle managers simply moved in and set up shop.
Exactly. When the executive level voluntarily blinds itself, the servant class managers like Lai Da and Wuxing Deng gain immense unchecked power.
Because they have the data.
Right. They control the ledgers. They control the flow of information. They decide what the masters see and what they don't. In reality, the servants become the shadow rulers of the estate.
That's wild.
They are the ones actually running the imperial usury schemes, leveraging the Jia family name to extort the public, while the masters float above it all in a bubble of cultivated ignorance.
Okay, I have to say, I'm not buying Ji Zheng's excuse for a second.
Yeah.
No. Even with the cultural context of Confucian purity, how can you be the patriarch, the head of massive house with hundreds of dependents, and not realize the vault is empty?
It takes a lot of effort to ignore that.
He's like a clueless CEO who spends all his time giving keynote speeches on corporate ethics, completely obsessed with his public profile as a visionary, but he never once speaks to a CFO or looks at a balance sheet until the FBI is literally carrying boxes of hard drives out of the lobby.
It is the ultimate failure of stewardship. He wanted the prestige of the position without the friction of the responsibility. And what makes this dynamic even more fascinating is how the broader society, the elite circle surrounding the Jia family, reacts to this exposure.
Because you would think, in a highly moralistic society, his peers would condemn this failure.
You really would.
You would think they'd walk into his parlor and say, Jia Zhang, your house is a disaster, your servants are running extortion rackets in your name, you need to tear this down and rebuild.
But that is not what happens at all.
Not even close. Once the dust of the raid settles, friends and relatives start visiting to offer their condolences, and they completely aggressively absolve him of any blame.
They circle the wagons with incredible speed.
They sit in his parlor and construct a completely alternate narrative right to his face. They tell him, listen, we know you. You are a pure scholar. You don't care about money. It's those muddy-legged servants of yours. They went out into the world, they abused your good name, they spread rumors, they engaged in greed, and they ruined your pristine reputation.
What we are seeing here is the psychology of elite solidarity functioning as a defense mechanism. These visitors aren't just protecting Jia Zhang's feelings.
No, they're protecting themselves.
Exactly. They are actively constructing a narrative that protects the aristocracy as an entire social class.
Because if the system is broken here, it might be broken everywhere.
Exactly. The logic they are desperately trying to enforce is this. The hierarchical system of nobility is fundamentally sound. The masters, by virtue of their birth and education, are inherently virtuous.
Right. We are the good guys.
Therefore, any systemic corruption must originate from the lower classes, the greedy, uneducated, muddy-legged workers who simply cannot handle the temptation of proximity to wealth.
They are entirely severing the cause from the effect.
Mm-hmm.
The guests want to blame the symptom, the corrupt servants, while entirely excusing the disease, which is the absentee leadership and willful negligence of the elite class.
That's classic deflection.
Think about modern crisis PR. When a company fails, how often is the blame shifted to, like, low-level rogue employees just to protect the board of directors?
A lot of time.
But what makes this so layered is that the guests aren't entirely lying.
Mm.
The servants were corrupt. The middle managers were shaking people down.
They were. But they were only able to do so because the masters created an ecosystem that rewarded opacity and punished transparency. The parlor scene is a masterclass in cognitive dissonance.
Right.
If these visiting nobles admit that Jia Zhang's negligence is the root cause of the ruin, they have to go home and audit their own households.
And nobody wants to do that.
They have to look at their own ledgers. And they are terrified of what they might find. So it is much safer to agree that the servant class is inherently treacherous.
But not every visitor is playing this polite philosophical game of denial. The text gives us a brilliant, jarring contrast.
Sun Xiaozu.
Yes, a son-in-law, a man named Sun Xiaozu. He doesn't come to the parlor. He doesn't offer tea or philosophical comfort. He sends a servant to demand that a massive debt be paid immediately.
He does not care about their feeling.
He offers zero sympathy to his ruined in-laws. Mm-hmm. He just wants his silver.
Sun Xiaozu strips away the polite veneer of aristocratic loyalty and exposes the brutal transactional reality of their world.
He is incredibly cold.
He is cold, but he is operating on the true physics of their society. The polite, fawning friends are maintaining a protective illusion. Sun Xiaozu exposes the fact that elite family ties are often built entirely on leverage.
Right, it's just business.
Exactly. When the Jia family had imperial favor, wealth, and power, Sun Xiaozu was deferential. He was tied to their rising star.
But now?
The absolute second that leverage evaporates, his familial loyalty vanishes. He treats them not as family in mourning, but as a failing counterparty in a contract. It demonstrates that without leverage, you are prey, even to the people who married into your family.
And as if the financial vulture circling aren't enough, another relative, Zhu Ke, arrives with a terrifying update.
The bad news just keeps coming.
He tells them that despite the emperor's nice pardon, there is a specific official in the brocade guard, a man named Zhao, who is aggressively pursuing the criminal case against the other branch of the family.
Official Zhao is not letting it go.
The investigation hasn't stopped. The wolves are still in the woods.
It shatters the illusion that the crisis is over. The pardon was merely a pause button, a temporary reprieve granted for political optics. The sprawling legal and political machinery of the state is still active, still grinding forward, still looking for vulnerabilities.
So while the men are sitting in that parlor, hiding behind these PR excuses, blaming the lower classes and ignoring the wolves, the narrative forces us to pivot.
A really important pivot.
Because the text takes us out of the public, performative space of the men and drags us into the deeply private, incredibly raw space of the women.
And this transition is where the true emotional and psychological pull of the collapse is localized. The men theorize about the failure. The women actually absorb the impact.
We shift our focus to a Wang Shifeng. Now, for those who aren't deeply familiar with the lore of the Jia family, Wang Shifeng is not just a wife.
No, she is a powerhouse.
She was the architect. She was the brilliant, ruthless, tactical manager of the entire household's day-to-day operations. While the men read poetry, Xifeng ran the empire.
She kept everything moving.
But right now, she is bedridden. She is dying. The physical reality of the raid has broken her. That massive private fortune we talked about earlier, the 80,000 pieces of gold and silver, was hers.
It was her personal war chest.
It was the war chest she built through her own ruthless management and, frankly, her own usury. And it was stripped away by the raiders. Now she is just weeping endlessly.
She has been entirely hollowed out. Her physical health has collapsed in tandem with her financial power. They were deeply, inextricably interconnected.
Her loyal maid, Pinger, is standing by the bed, begging to call a doctor. But Xifeng absolutely refuses. She tells Pinger she wants to die.
She's given up.
And in this moment, she does something that not a single man in the parlor was capable of doing. She admits fault.
Yes.
She looks at her ruin and she admits that her own greed, her own endless grasping for more wealth and more control, caused this.
The contrast in self-awareness is staggering. I mean, Jia Zhang blames the abstract nature of the servants. Ji Lian blames the paperwork. Xifeng, the operational mastermind, claims total agency over her failure.
He owns it.
She knows exactly what she did. She knows the corners she cut, the lives she ruined to build her hoard. And she understands the direct causal link between her ambition and the raid.
And she is terrified, not just of what has already happened, but of what is coming.
The other shoe dropping.
She confesses to Pinger about a looming scandal that hasn't even broken yet. She talks about a situation where a male relative, Jia Zhen, forced a woman to become a concubine, which ultimately led to a suicide involving a man named Mr. Zhang.
It's a dark secret.
Sheikh Min knows that if official Zhao and the brocade guard keep digging, this is going to be exhumed. And if it is, her husband Jia Lian will be implicated because he helped engineer the cover-up.
Her psychological burden is immensely heavy because she possesses the one thing the men lack. Foresight.
Right. She can see what's coming.
She understands the interconnected ecosystem of their crimes. She sees the dominoes falling in slow motion. The raid was just the first domino.
Here's where it gets really interesting. What she fears most reveals so much about the cultural stakes of this collapse. Look at the contrast. The men in the parlor are terrified of losing their physical lives, their official titles, and their property. But Weinchfeng, she is terrified of losing her Mianzi, her face, her reputation. She tells Pinger she cannot bear the shame of being exposed. She says, "I strove to be on top my whole life, but now I will fall behind everyone."
For Jifgang, her entire identity, her core sense of self, was built on hyper-capability. She was the smartest person in the room.
Always.
She manipulated the massive archaic system of the Jia family better than anyone else. She was the untouchable fixer. So for her, the prospect of being publicly exposed as a fraud, of having her intricate schemes dragged into the light and shown to be the very things that destroyed the family, is a fate significantly worse than physical death.
It's the ultimate humiliation.
Exactly. The men can fall back on the excuse of ignorance. Xifeng knows she can never claim ignorance because she was the one pulling every single string.
She's like a brilliant but ruthless corporate fixer who finally hits a wall she can't scheme her way out of.
The leverage is gone.
The state audit was too deep, the secret police were in the building, and her leverage evaporated. But her reaction, refusing the doctor, desiring death, it raises a really complex question.
It does.
Is her desire to die a noble acceptance of responsibility? Like, is she saying, "I played the game, I lost, I will accept my punishment"? Or is this the ultimate final evasion of consequences? Is she just checking out before the real trial begins?
That is the defining tragic tension of her character in this moment, and realistically, it is both.
Both.
Yeah. Her confession to Pinger is the most brutally honest moment of accountability we have witnessed in the text. She owns her darkness. But choosing death is also the ultimate refusal to face the music.
She doesn't want to stand in court.
She does not want to stand in an imperial courtroom. She does not want to face the judgment of the society she once dominated. It is a desperate assertion of control in a universe where she has lost all other forms of agency. If she dies on her own terms, in her own bed, she avoids the public humiliation of living as a ruined, powerless woman.
It is a devastating end for the architect. And yet, she isn't the only woman in the estate taking on the crushing emotional burden of the family sins.
No, the matriarch is heavily burdened, too.
Right. While Xifeng is carrying the weight of the tactical operational crimes, Grandmother Jia is carrying a much deeper, more existential weight, the weight of generational failure. Which brings us to one of the most profound scenes in the entire novel.
We return to Grandmother Jia, the 80-year-old woman we saw hyperventilating at the beginning of the raid. But the panic has subsided into something much more solemn and heavy.
She hobbles out into the main courtyard, leaning heavily on her cane. She orders the servants to prepare the altar and burn incense.
A very formal ritual.
She lays out a prayer mat. She slowly kneels down and she prays to heaven. And her prayer is a gut punch. It is the absolute antithesis of the men making excuses in the parlor.
It acts as the moral anchor of the entire narrative.
She begs the heavens to let her and her alone take the punishment for the family's sins. She asks that her descendants be spared from the wrath of the state. And she admits out loud to the open sky that her family is proud, extravagant, and reckless.
She lays it all out.
She says, "I failed to educate my children and grandchildren, and that is why this disaster has fallen upon us."
Grandmother Jia is tapping into a deeply ingrained theological and philosophical concept in Chinese culture. Baoying, or cosmic retribution, intertwined with the concept of collective generational karma.
It's a huge theme.
Right. While Jia Zhang is obsessing over the missing silver and his political title, Grandmother Jia is looking at a century of spiritual decay. She recognizes that the massive wealth and privilege her family enjoyed for generations was not a divine right. It was a cosmic loan that came with the responsibility of virtue.
And they defaulted on that loan.
They completely abandoned that responsibility. They became arrogant. They wasted vast resources on fleeting pleasures. And she, as the eldest, the matriarch, who presided over the golden era of the family, views herself as the root of the rot because she indulged them. She permitted the extravagance.
And her prayer acts as a catalyst. It sparks this massive, house-wide breaking of the emotional dam.
The tension just snaps.
The women, the servants, everyone in the courtyard just begins weeping. The sheer weight of what they have lost crashes over them. And amidst this sea of grief, the narrative zooms in on Baiyu.
Baiyu's reaction is so poignant.
Yeah. Now, Baiyu is the young, incredibly sensitive heir to the family. He has been the golden child raised in the idyllic, poetic sanctuary of the Grandview Garden, surrounded by brilliant young women. And Baiyu is crying, but his grief is fundamentally different from everyone else's.
What's fascinating here is his internal monologue. It is uniquely profound, and it highlights the philosophical core of Dream of the Red Chamber.
He looks around at the ruin, and he is suddenly struck by his own complete, utter uselessness. He isn't mourning the confiscated property or the last political leverage. He is mourning the fact that Shi Xiangyun, one of his close relatives, a brilliant, vibrant, poetic young woman, is suddenly being forced into an arranged marriage by her uncle.
She's a casualty of the collapse.
Because the Ji family is ruined, she has lost her protective sanctuary. She's essentially being sold off to secure an alliance or clear a debt in the harsh reality of the outside world. For Bai Yu, her fate symbolizes the violent, permanent end of their youthful artistic days in the garden.
You have this incredible juxtaposition of grief. The adult men weep for the machinery of power titles, estates, silver, but Bao Yu weeps for the loss of innocence and the shattering of beauty.
It's heartbreaking.
He is mourning the scattering of the young women who represented purity, art, and genuine emotion in his life. The Grandview Garden was a fragile, protected bubble where poetry mattered more than politics.
And the raid burst the bubble.
And what is most devastating for Bao Yu is the realization that despite all the intense love and adoration he received his entire life, he is completely powerless. He has no tools to stop the brutal transactional machinery of the adult world from crushing the people he loves.
Have you ever looked at a situation and realized the exact moment the golden days were over?
Yeah, that sudden shift.
It's the realization that the physical world, the wealth, the garden itself, it was all an illusion. The Taoist and Buddhist themes of the novel really crystallize here.
They really do.
Bao Yu is experiencing that sudden sinking feeling where you realize a chapter of your life is permanently closed and you can never go back. He was raised to be a poet, and suddenly he is thrust into a world of secret police and debt collectors, and his poetry cannot save a single person.
It is the death of youth. The garden walls have been breached. The harsh, unforgiving reality of the imperial state has flooded in, and the illusion of safety is gone forever.
And speaking of that harsh, unforgiving reality, after the incense burns down and the tears dry, reality sets back in.
Back to the ledger.
Because cosmic karma is heavy, but it doesn't balance the books. Tears do not pay off the loans. Jia Zhang, finally, reluctantly, has to do the one thing he has avoided his entire adult life.
He has to conduct an audit. He has to actually look at the math.
He demands the household ledgers. He calls in Lai Da, the head manager, and asks for the physical employee roles and the balance sheets. And what he discovers in those pages is the true structural definition of systemic rot.
This is the moment the abstract failure becomes quantified, and the numbers are staggering.
Jia Zhang discovers that they have 212 servants on the payroll. And that is just for their specific branch of the family spread across over 30 separate households.
That's a massive overhead.
He then looks at the revenue streams. The income from their provincial agricultural estates, the actual foundation of their wealth, is less than half of what it was during their ancestors' time. The yields are down, the rents are drying up, but their expenses are 10 times higher.
Let's just sit with that mathematical impossibility for a second. Income is down by 50%. Expenses are up by 1,000%. As the text describes it, they were spending the year of the tiger's money in the year of the ox.
Just burning through it.
It is the definition of terminal financial velocity. They were sustaining a hyper-extravagant, performative lifestyle. The theatrical troupes, the massive banquets, the seasonal wardrobes, the endless bribes required to maintain face in the capital by draining the very lifeblood of the estate.
But the horrifying math isn't even the climax of this audit.
No, it gets worse.
Jia Zhang is looking closely at the ledgers, trying to match the names to the faces, and he discovers something that completely shatters his understanding of his own reality. He is looking for a specific name, Bao Er.
Bao Er.
Earlier, Jia Zhang was told that it was a servant named Bao Er who had been out in the streets spreading rumors, running extortion rackets, and destroying Jia Zhang's reputation as a pure, uncorrupted official. So Jia Zhang wants to find Bao Er on the official employee register to drag him into the courtyard and punish him.
But he scans the rolls, line by line, and the name isn't there.
Bao Er isn't on the list. He does not exist on paper. Jia Zhang looks at his managers and demands, "How is this man operating in my name, destroying my life, if he doesn't even work for me?"
And the answer is terrifying.
The managers casually explain that Bao Er was brought in temporarily by another servant years ago. He bounced around doing odd jobs for different branches of the family, and eventually he just stayed. He operated entirely off the books, entirely in the shadows.
The managers use a specific chilling phrase to describe this: slaves having slaves.
Wow.
This is the ultimate terminal breakdown of the organizational hierarchy. The official servants, the ones who are actually on the payroll, had become so comfortable, so entrenched in their own acquired status that they began subcontracting their own manual labor to undocumented, desperate workers like Bauer.
This is the ultimate nightmare for any manager. It is an ecosystem of parasites feeding on parasites. Think about the terrifying autonomy of an undocumented shadow workforce.
It's completely unchecked.
You have a phantom IT contractor who doesn't exist on HR's payroll, who was brought in for a weekend gig years ago, who never left, but who somehow has the CEO's email password and is shaking down clients.
Wow.
I mean, at this point, does it even matter who is officially in charge if the bottom layer of the pyramid is entirely autonomous?
And the epiphany that hits Jia Zhang in this moment is absolute and crushing. He realizes that his carefully cultivated reputation, his precious aesthetic of Confucian purity, wasn't destroyed by his own action.
No.
It wasn't even destroyed by the servants he officially hired. It was destroyed by a ghost. It was destroyed by an undocumented off-the-books actor who wielded the Jia name as a weapon simply because Jia Zhang refused to look down and see who was actually standing inside his own house.
It is the ultimate inversion of power. The bottom layer of the pyramid, the completely unaccountable shadow workers, are the ones who wield the actual operational power on the streets. They dictate the reality.
The masters are irrelevant.
Jia Zhang realizes that his organizational chart is a fiction. He is just a hostage in his own home, holding the liability while the ghosts hold the leverage.
The host has been entirely consumed by the parasites, and the host didn't even notice until the state arrived to burn the body.
And right at that exact moment of realization, right as Jia Zhang is standing there holding the ledgers, staring into the abyss of his own willful blindness, realizing the rot is unfixable, the universe interrupts.
The timing is incredible. A messenger bursts into the room, breathless.
The messenger says, "Please, master, you must hurry. The emperor is demanding your immediate presence in the inner court."
The pause button has been deactivated. The machinery of the state is moving again. And Jia Zhang has to walk out the door, head to the palace, having absolutely no idea if he is walking into a trap, a demotion, or his own execution.
It is a breathtaking cliffhanger.